sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artist in Residence program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. The deadline to apply to be the 2014 KABU Artist in Residence is February 14th. More information on the Artist in Residence program, including eligibility, selection process, and the application, can be found at kabu.fm/AIR2014.
The time is 5:04 and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is the Monday Evening News. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, whose series on government in our daily lives provides local and state speakers. The February 11th event will focus on agriculture and food production in practice, in the economy, and in the government. Information can be found online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on our hour-long membership drive special of the KABU Evening News, Medford teachers are on strike and the district starts busing in sub-scabs from around the state.
The NFL looks forward to its first openly gay linebacker.
President Obama continues to seek a legal rationale for his assassination of U.S. citizens abroad.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 10th, 2014. KABU is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by calling 877-500-5266. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. The Medford School District has canceled tonight's school board meeting due to the imminent teacher strike. Today, Medford School District bused in more substitute teachers in an attempt to break the teacher strike. Subs from the Portland metro area, Josephine County, the coast, and central and eastern Oregon, all with teaching experience, had their credentials reviewed and went through a drug screening. Contract bargaining is scheduled to resume Wednesday between the district school board and the Medford Education Association. The district's decided use of revenue is the main reason behind the strike. Both sides remain apart on several items, including how much teachers should be paid, how to end or phase out early retirement benefits, how to divvy up insurance premiums, and whether contracts should be 2 or 3 year terms. Language regarding working conditions is up for debate. The school board declared a state of emergency January 29th. The school board will meet in executive session as needed through the duration of the strike. Emergency resolutions gave school board superintendent Phil Long extra authority, prohibited picketing on school property, restricted signs and banners on district facilities, and authorized spending to continue school operations during a strike.
And the Portland Association of Teachers has set a strike date of February 20th if an agreement cannot be reached with Portland Public Schools. The school district is preparing in case the strike happens, and they report that 3 days of school would immediately be canceled following a walkout. The priority will be placed on opening elementary and middle schools first, followed by high schools. With 2,900 teachers expected to walk out and only 800 substitute teachers within the district, who are also represented by the union, keeping schools open will be a huge challenge. Portland Public Schools is attempting to recruit out-of-district substitute teachers, guaranteeing them 5 days of pay, regardless of the walkout length. District officials also stated in a document, replacement teachers, Portland Public Schools substitute teachers and substitute education assistants will staff schools and support the 48,000 kids within the district. The district also issued a statement, "Our highest priorities will be to continue providing a safe and secure environment for our youngest students and to ensure that students have access to meals at school so that children are not hungry." Currently, students receive about 36,000 meals a day from the district. Negotiations and preparations continue as the two sides are meeting today, Monday, with a state mediator.
Concerned citizens, along with Rising Tide, will hold a rally tomorrow, Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m. at the port of Umatilla to confront the third megaload moving through Oregon headed to the Alberta tar sands. Equipment shipped in this load will be used for extracting bitumen supplying the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. There have been over 10 regional actions in the past 2 months in response to megaloads and tar sands extraction. A major concern for activists is that Oregon is becoming a long-term corridor for heavy haul equipment bound for the tar sands and other fossil fuel infrastructure projects.
The Oregon legislature was back in session today after a two-day recess last Thursday and Friday because of the weather. One of the items that was heard in committee today was a bill that would restrict the use of license plate cameras by law enforcement. Here's a clip of the testimony from this morning's hearing from Becky Strauss of the Oregon ACLU.
If you have a 14-day retention period on innocent people's data, and law enforcement finds that that data may be needed later, they would like to hold on to it because they have a particular reason for whatever criminal purpose, criminal investigation purpose that they need it, they'd like to keep it longer than that 14 days. Law enforcement can go to the court and say, we have a reasonable suspicion that this data is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, and the court can then decide to grant a court order to extend beyond that 14 days. In the bill as drafted, those court orders are limited to 30-day increments. We'll see in the Dash 2, 3, and 4 amendments that we've extended out that 30 days to 180 days and actually put in an additional safety valve, if you will, exception on that 180-day court order if there's an additional showing of exceptional circumstances, for example, a cold case or a kidnapping that's taking a very long time to solve. A law enforcement agency could say to the court, 180-day renewals or 180-day renewals is too burdensome. Finally, in the bill as drafted, we've put in some attempts to address transparency and accountability in Section 4 to say that agencies using this surveillance technology must write and post on their website the policies that they use to govern the use of the technology and must post those reports annually on how they are using them.
That was testimony from this morning's hearing at the Oregon State Capitol in Salem on the Senate bill to restrict the use of license plate camera data by law enforcement here in Oregon. The Senate Committee on General Government will vote on whether to send the bill to the full Senate this coming Wednesday.
An All-American college football player has come out as gay, and he's expected to be the first openly gay professional football player. Michael Sam is a defensive lineman on the Missouri Tigers college football team. Michael was a first-team All-American and was named the Associated Press Defensive Player of the Year in the Southeastern Conference last year. His teammates also voted him Missouri's Most Valuable Player. Michael's currently preparing for the NFL draft and is expected to be selected in the early rounds. At a team-building exercise this past fall, players were asked to talk about themselves. As Michael Sam began to speak, he announced to his teammates that he is gay. Now, the college senior has come out publicly in an interview with ESPN yesterday. He is entering into uncharted territory with no openly gay athletes in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, or the National Hockey League. Football as a sport, and the NFL in particular, have a reputation for promoting an overly macho culture. The NFL has publicly declared that they are excited to welcome Michael Sam to the league.
KABU volunteers work hard to bring you this locally produced newscast every single evening. Now we are asking you to do the same. Joining us now are Paul and Arya to talk about how you can support KABU Community Radio.
Thank you, Robert. And yes, we are here, and we are asking you to call 877-500-5266. We'd like
okay,
to hear those phones start ringing out here, and that would mean that you are taking seriously this community responsibility. We are all in this together, and that's the only way we can keep going is by you expressing your support in various ways, not just financially, but this at this time of year, during these membership drives, we do ask you to dig down into your pocketbook, whatever you've got, any amount is good, and give us a call.
Yes, please, and you can visit our website if you have internet at www.kboo.fm, and you can contribute there online, or you can just volunteer. You can any amount of help would help. Actually, we're all volunteers, and you can't get real news, but on KBOO,
we do dig a lot of stuff up. I mean, we're really honing this all volunteer newscast format, and we have exposed stories like the American Legislative Exchange Council was exposed as the author of the Monsanto Protection Act. We've exposed radiation levels in Oregon with No Nukes Northwest, exclusive updates from the Portland Teachers Union about the negotiations and upcoming strike, as well as live reports from the front lines of student and teacher rallies. Now, you do get some of, you know, there's an overlap of information with, you know, the other public radio station in town and other news sources. It's not that they don't cover any of this, but they don't tend to be right there with the people directly affected as much as KBOO is. And they don't tend to go into it quite as in-depth as KBOO does. And those are some of the reasons. We could give you many more, but you know the reasons because you're listening to it. You know why KBOO is important. We don't have to convince you. So express your support and give us a call at 877-500-5266.
And we do have events at KBOO that broadcast live every year. And the World War II Radio Christmas, the Elahi Lecter Series, 5 talks on who owns you and what you can do about it, and a 2-part panel on the women's movement in Portland. There's many, many things that other radio stations will not cover that we do, and we do need all your help, like $5, $2, just send it to us if you can, and go around your couch and find some change. Give it to
anything
us.
Helps, as Aria says. We do appreciate that. And call us at 877-500-5266. Now back to the newscast.
How did life on Earth start? What is the difference between self-replicating systems and life itself? These are some of the questions asked by biological chemists and, according to Quanta Magazine, a Georgia Institute of Technology research group, recently came up with some tantalizing clues. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer filed this report.
Biological chemists have been researching the origin of life on Earth, asking how did the extremely complex molecules necessary for life first self-synthesize out of the old primordial pond. Nicholas Hudd of the Georgia Institute of Technology explains the research.
RNA is a molecule that's very close in chemical structure to DNA, which we know is the molecule that stores genetic information. And so one of the leading hypotheses for about the last 30 years has been that first molecule that got life started is RNA. But nobody's been able to come up with a way for how RNA could have formed before we had cellular life. And so this is something that we're trying to understand, is how this molecule could have come about and got life started if you need life to make it.
What is really the difference, would you say, between a replicating or a self-replicating molecule or system and life itself?
We think about life as a replicating system, like cells that divide or animals or plants that give rise to their progeny. But we can also think about the possibility that there were very simple molecular systems, maybe even individual molecules that were able to either copy themselves or by the assistance of other molecules in the environment that they could spontaneously have another identical copy of themselves made. And so that would be a type of self-replication. And if you have molecules like RNA and DNA that do this, that also can store information, such as in the code like we think of in DNA, then there's a possibility that they can evolve, just like we know life evolves today, in a more simple way. But if they could evolve, then they could get more complex, and that could be really the start of life as we know it.
I guess there's not really a strong dividing line between life and non-life, according to that definition.
Yeah, that's a really big question that's ongoing. That goes hand in hand with the question about what is the definition of life? When is it that we say, oh, this is not living and this becomes living? We believe as chemists is that life started from very simple molecules that came together and formed more complex molecules, and then increasingly they were able to do more and more sophisticated chemical reactions, culminating in those that we have in the cell today. But at what point we say this was not living and now it is living, that's still a matter that is debated by people that work in the field.
Can you go over the research in your laboratory then?
What we've been doing is we've been looking at the possibility that maybe before we had the molecules we have in life today, that what we had were actually ancestors of those molecules. Molecules that their chemical structure were a little bit different than what we have today. And by doing that, we also make it possible to have chemical reactions that happen more readily than they would with the molecules that we use in life today. So what my laboratory has discovered is that if we take the molecules that we know are at the center of DNA and RNA today, and we consider that those molecules, which we call the bases, are a little bit different, we actually find molecules that in water, they come together, they assemble, and they even react with the sugar ribose, and they start to make parts of what look like RNA, and they make long assemblies that start to look like, you know, what you might need to even get gene length molecules together.
Well, when you say self-assembling, I mean, we're still bound by the laws of thermodynamics, presumably.
Right. And that's been a guiding principle in my laboratory, which is that the molecules that started life are ones that are special in that they can assemble in water with each other, that they can form very regular assemblies. And the analogy that I like to make with self-assembly is that we see it all the time in the world in the formation of crystals, for example, or we see it in the formation of snowflakes from water, right? We know that molecules will come together and form regular patterns. What we've been looking for are molecules that will come together and form patterns that we would expect to be the start of the molecules of life.
That was Nicholas Hudd of the Georgia Institute of Technology. His group recently came up with a recipe for making RNA-like molecules. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
You're listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We're reminding you that you can call us to renew your KBOO membership or to become a member at any time during this program by simply calling 877-500-5266. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. In the weather, showers are expected tonight with a low around 40. The rain will likely continue tomorrow with a high of only around 45 degrees.
It's 5:22. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Were you invited to the big doings in Davos? You know, the annual powwow of power elites held in that posh resort town in the Swiss Alps. The World Economic Forum, as it's formally called, brings together a bunch of corporate chieftains, the heads of state from various countries, an A-list of entertainment sparklies, and a horde of economists, consultants, and lesser politicos trying to get noticed. The theme of this year's Wine, Dine, and Shine show was the reshaping of the world. How modest is that? But you can't expect modesty from an event that's been dubbed, quote, a velvet rope club for the 1% of the 1%. Or, as the mayor of London once put it, a constellation of egos involved in massive mutual orgies of adulation. Maybe that's why the big news from Davos this year was not who attended, but the platinum-level biggies who spurned the invite, such as Warren Buffett, along with the honchos of Apple, Facebook, and Google. It seems that many are put off by the declining level of speakers and panelists. As if to emphasize that decline, the forum organizers even brought in Governor Rick Oops Perry of Texas to be on a healthcare panel. Now that's industrial strength chutzpah. After 14 years as governor, Perry's state still has a fourth of its people with no health insurance, the ugliest performance of all 50 states. Indeed, if Davos attendees need an example of how a public official who enjoys government-paid health care can so crassly deny any coverage to millions of the less fortunate, Perry's their man. This is Jim Hightower saying, adding to the forum's unintended satire of elites without a clue, a major sub-theme this year was how to address economic inequality. One way would be to invite at least one person who's on the receiving end of inequality. Maybe one of Rick Perry's uninsured constituents. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The Associated Press reports that the Obama administration is wrestling with what to do about a United States citizen they suspect of planning attacks against Americans overseas. To date, the CIA has assassinated at least four U.S. citizens in drone strikes and at least 1,000 times as many non-citizens. However, outrage over the extrajudicial killings has forced Obama to promise to more closely follow United States and international law. For more on this, Cable's Joe Meyer spoke with Notre Dame law professor Mary Ellen O'Connell.
U.S. intelligence claims that an American member of al-Qaeda is in a country that refuses U.S. military action on its soil. This presents a bit of a conundrum for President Obama, since his new policy says that American suspected terrorists may only be killed by the military, not the CIA. I asked law professor Mary Ellen O'Connell about the history of the U.S. drone program.
The United States has been carrying out these unlawful military attacks outside armed conflict zones for over 11 years now, and so that very first strike was found by the United Nations to have been an extrajudicial summary execution and unlawful. The Obama administration said they were going to abandon the unlawful conduct of the global war on terror, and they did at least stop using torture, but they did not close down Guantanamo, which they had said they would at least try to do. Drone strikes have been an entirely different story. They've tried every year another argument to justify these killings. There is no justification in international law for the use of military force to kill people who are outside a zone of hostilities. And no matter how many times the Obama administration rewrites their speeches, they can't change that rule of fundamental international law. And I really am so beside myself about why they're even trying. And the one time when they really do seem to get the attention of our members of Congress is when they carry out a killing against an American.
I asked Professor O'Connell why the CIA runs the U.S. drone program and not the military.
The CIA was given the job of carrying out drone strikes in 2002, that first attack that I told you about, because the Air Force said that they had concerns about the legality of that first strike in Yemen. And of course, the Air Force was right. There was no legal right for the U.S. to carry out a missile strike in Yemen. The CIA had no legal concerns. And that's, as far as I can tell, the main reason why the CIA took over this job, even though after the Church Committee reported, the CIA was taken out of killing lethal operations entirely by the Congress. This happened a year after 9/11, and the CIA has continued carrying out killing operations ever since. There are a lot of problems with that. The first and most important problem is that they're carrying out killings in places where the U.S. has no legal right to carry out lethal operations. The second is, the CIA doesn't get trained in lethal operations. We have a trained FBI to carry out police operations throughout the United States and when requested by foreign governments. We have a military that are trained to carry out lethal operations
in other countries. I know what training they get because I was a professional military educator. I'm married to a combat veteran. The CIA doesn't get anything like the kind of training in the Geneva Conventions, rules of international humanitarian law that apply in the battlefield, and yet they're carrying out these killing operations. So it is a huge miscarriage of the law for the CIA to be involved in lethal operations at all.
What would Obama have to do to stop the assassinations?
He can stop this tomorrow. It is really ultimately his responsibility that this policy has gone forward. He and President Bush before him apparently waived the presidential executive order that President Reagan brought into effect that limits and prevents the CIA from carrying out lethal operations. So if President Obama were to sign that order tomorrow, it would end.
Finally, I ask about the difference in policy towards U.S. and non-U.S. humans.
I mean, this is part of what makes people around the world so angry with us and unwilling to cooperate with us in terms of criminal matters and making sure that the problem of terrorism is handled as best as can be done. They don't want to cooperate with a country that will blow a wedding convoy to smithereens based on suspicions of the CIA that there are terrorists in that wedding convoy. These kinds of activities, and the U.S. doesn't even hesitate when they're non-Americans. Apparently, we've hesitated in the case of this current individual because he's an American. You can understand how that sounds to people in Yemen who have lost a family member attending a wedding, or a young boy in Pakistan whose father was killed in front of his eyes, or children who saw their grandmother obliterated while she was picking vegetables in a garden patch. This is not how you get cooperation in responding to the problem of terrorism.
That was Notre Dame law professor Mary Ellen O'Connell. Although Obama could halt the drone assassination with a signature, he continues to search for legal justification. And I'm Joe Meyer with KABU News.
You're listening to a membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. Our volunteers work hard every day to bring you this coverage of local, national, and international news. So now it's your turn. Joining us now are Paul and Aria to talk about how you can support KABU Community Radio.
And we are in our membership drive here at KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul, and I'm here with Aria, and we do
Hello.
Appreciate your support. This is a volunteer-based community broadcast. You know that. You've heard it before. You probably have heard this broadcast before. You appreciate the news you hear. You appreciate the work that our volunteers do to go out and get the news, to make the connections. We do it every day, Monday through Friday. And we really need your support to keep it going. And the only way to do that, well, there's several ways to do that. One way is by calling right now, 877-500-5266.
Yes, or visit our website at www.kboo.fm, and you can learn more about us. And after you learn more about us, you will know why we need your contributions. And without your contributions, we wouldn't exist, and you would just be hearing mainstream media, which basically might not tell you everything you need to know.
That is true. And, you know, one thing to look forward to in the future, I don't know if you've heard that KBOO received a grant to investigate the American Legislative Exchange Council's ties to Oregon legislation. So this is going to be a six-month investigative project coming out of the KBOO news team. And a one paid staff person who has been hired to do that. And that should be something to look forward to. You know, that's a story we've reported on. We broke the story about Monsanto writing the, or Alec writing the Monsanto Protection Act. And that's just something that we hope to expand upon over the coming months. And the only way to keep that, the continuity going of this really great active news team that comes in here in the afternoons every day to put in their hours and get the news stories out to you. The way to show your support for their hard work is by calling 877-500-5266.
Exactly. And you won't hear Democracy Now! often, only on KBOO, and it's Amy Goodman, as we heard. And I forgot to mention that Jeremy Scahill is following me on Twitter, so I was very, very excited when he did that. So where else are you going to hear on the radio? You're not going to hear him on classic rock or
that's for
any
sure.
other station.
Definitely not. Jeremy Scahill, those voices tend to be marginalized by the mainstream media, people who want to talk truthfully about the realities of American power projection around the world and the dirty wars that Jeremy Scahill has both written about and produced a documentary about. And, you know, we do have some thank you gifts for you. For a minimum $60 pledge, you can get a subscription to Yes Magazine, quarterly magazine published by the Positive Futures Network. I had one of those subscriptions, and I really appreciated it. They really give some really interesting takes on news, and I think their recent issue is just having something about the Megalodes issue that you've been hearing about a lot on KBOO. So, you know, we also spur others to take up stories. We're, you know, traditionally alternative media has been a place that sometimes spins off stories that, you know, people mine KBOO and other alternative media sources to for their own news sources, some of the major media outlets. I don't know if they do that as much as they used to, but that's an important role for community radio and alternative, so-called alternative media. We really don't see ourselves as an alternative, but is to put things out there that maybe other people wouldn't necessarily have the courage or even the knowledge or connections to pick up on their own. So once again, this is our pledge. This is our membership drive. We're about halfway through, and we're trying to finish it on time. You can help us do that by giving us your support if you haven't done so already.
Yes, please do, and call us at 877-500-5266. And that will really, really help us. And just any amount would be fine and is tax deductible. And you know that we really need this to have this radio station running.
And any amount is fine. But, you know, if you can afford $10 a month, if you can take it out, we have an electronic funds transfer option. You can take $10 a month out. That's $120 a year. $5 a month would be $60 a year. Our basic membership is, of course, $40. We also have low-income membership of $20. And those, you know, get you some added benefits by getting some discounts at some local businesses. And, you know, we have ticket giveaways, lots of other things that we have here. We have a number of other thank you gifts, various books, Democracy Now! T-shirt. We have the old KBOO versus the Mediazillas T-shirt, which is a great T-shirt. It was backed by popular demand for a $75 minimum pledge.
They're wonderful gifts, and you do want to support your community, don't you? I mean, everybody does. And if you're new to Portland, you want to be part of our community. And if you're living in Portland, you do want to be contributing to your community. And we are your community, and we speak for you. And hopefully, you will find it in your pockets to just dig out and give it to KBOO.
And that's 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm.
A University of Michigan biologist has positively identified Monsanto's herbicide product, Roundup Ready, as a direct cause of the drastic decrease in the numbers of monarch butterflies. Roundup Ready is used with the increased plantings of herbicide-resistant GMO corn in parts of the Midwest that happen to be in the monarch migration zone. The chemical herbicide kills plants surrounding the GMO corn, including the milkweed, which the monarchs need on their journey from Canada to Mexico. The monarch decline mirrors the decline of the honeybee population. The World Wildlife Fund says that the monarch population is at an all-time low since they started tracking them in 1993. This winter, approximately 60 million monarch butterflies arrived in Mexico, which is down from the 350 million usual in recent years.
Farmers who donate the produce they grow to nonprofit groups don't receive a charitable tax deduction as individuals do for their donations. But the Oregon legislature is being asked to change that by reinstating a crop donation tax credit that expired in 2011. KBOO's Sequoia Wright has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon lawmakers are being asked to revive a charitable tax break for farmers who grow crops to donate to their local food banks and other nonprofit groups. The state used to offer a 10% tax credit for crop donations, but it wasn't enough to cover cost of harvesting the produce and transporting it to food banks. The new legislation would reinstate the credit and increase it to 15% of the donated crop's wholesale value. At Food for Lane County, Beverly Hughes says her organization has noticed a difference without the crop donation credit.
And we get lots of crops brought to us at the end of the harvest season, but those numbers have certainly dropped off since this tax credit sunsetted 2 years ago. We have seen some noticeable decreases in the amount of donations coming our way.
The Oregon Food Bank estimates with a 15% tax credit, every dollar will bring in about 11 pounds of donated food. Legislators will have to evaluate that return on investment against a potential $250,000 in decreased tax revenue. At Johnson Farms near Eugene, owner Walt Johnson says he still would grow and donate some crops without the tax credit. But like many other businesses, farmers are trying to cut seed, fuel, and other costs, and says it's less expensive to plow leftover crops than it is to share them.
By having the tax credit, I can plant a little extra. Basically, the biggest cost is in the harvest. And what we're looking at is what can we do to offset that? Because I got the will, but I just need an economic incentive to make it happen.
Molly McCarger of Paramine Farms says they routinely plant extra acres of green beans or corn to donate. Even though she thinks the paperwork to get the tax credit can be a hassle, she's among the farmers talking it up to lawmakers.
From what I could gather, they are in support of this concept. They see the need. They know that Oregon ranks in the top 5 nationally for hunger, and that's not acceptable when agriculture is one of your top industries in the state.
For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Sequoia Wright.
And now we go to our friends at National Native News for the latest headlines from Native America.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government has announced a new plan for First Nations education. The government will spend $1.2 billion over the next 3 years with First Nations control. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Sean Atleo, is hailing the plan. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, some Native leaders are skeptical.
The government's reworked plan for Native education sets minimum quality standards for reserve classrooms. At the same time, it leaves Aboriginal schooling under First Nations jurisdiction. The issue of Native education has been a controversial one for some time, and talks between the two sides had come near to collapsing several times over the past year. This plan calls for standards consistent with provincial standards off-reserve. It also says students will have to meet attendance requirements and teachers will have to be properly certified. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations says the deal is the beginning of a new era for First Nations children. Some Native leaders are cautiously optimistic about the plan, but others, such as Rachel Crow Spreading Wings, are upset the deal was made in private between the government and the AFN.
We will fight and stand up no matter what. And they need to listen to us, and that deal doesn't get signed. It's not something that happens behind closed doors.
Others object to the fact that not all First Nations were consulted. But in Ottawa, opposition politicians from both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals were cautiously optimistic. They agree it's a positive step towards a higher quality education for First Nations children. Some academics also agree, hoping that it could also mean more Native students on university campuses. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Two Lakota high school students have returned to South Dakota after acting as ambassadors for Badlands National Park during a trip to New York City. As Jim Kent reports, their recent cultural exchange was sponsored by a New York school.
Dewan Wilcox and Earl Lamont are part of the Badlands Youth Summer Intern Program.
Badlands National Park spokesperson Julie Jondrew says students from New York City's Calhoun School have visited the park for week-long exploration camps twice since 2012. Jondrew notes that as much as discovering what life is like in South Dakota was an eye-opener for the Calhoun School students, their trip to New York City was all that and more for the Lakota students.
We were there for 9 days, and the students stayed with a family from the Calhoun School, and I think that was a wonderful experience for them. There was a ninth grade student in the home, so they were able to be fully integrated as far as, you know, going out in the evening to Times Square and getting pizza or going to a souvenir shop.
But the trip wasn't all entertainment. The Lakota students also gave a presentation to second grade students about life in South Dakota and Badlands National Park, as well as answering questions about their culture. Badlands National Park staff can only work with a few kids in their intern and ambassador program, but Julie Jondrew says the one-on-one attention that permits is helping to put those students on the right path to becoming tomorrow's leaders. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A measure to provide in-state tuition for Native Americans from tribes with historical ties to Colorado is advancing in the state legislature. The bill passed a House committee last week. Sponsor Joe Salazar says it would make higher education more accessible for those facing economic hardships. Fort Lewis College, located in Durango, already provides full tuition for Native students from federally recognized tribes. Salazar's bill now heads to another committee for consideration. In February 1983, the United Nations granted Category 2 non-governmental organization status to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. The ICC represents Inuit people in Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Russia. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
A pair of environmental activists have exposed a common practice of oil companies involved in cleanup operations, which they've termed double dipping. The companies get paid twice for cleanup of fuel oil, once from the government and then again from insurance companies. And these oil companies are often the very same ones responsible for the oil leaks to begin with. The pair of activists that exposed the practice are Thomas Schrubin, an environmental engineer, and Dennis Patanzi, a lawyer. They put together a team of investigators and experts to find evidence of companies double-dipping and have brought the results to state agencies. They have now opened up 20 cases all over the country. Most of the cleanup operations involve leaky steel tanks located under and around gas stations. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has declared these tanks to be the greatest threat to groundwater in the country. These tanks were built for gas stations during the 50s and 60s highway boom. They have corroded over time, releasing gas and diesel with cancer-causing chemicals into aquifers and under properties. According to Reuters, 9 states have won settlements worth more than $105 million against Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, and Sunoco in the past 3 years. The companies have not admitted any wrongdoing.
Now is your chance to show support for the work our volunteers put in to bring you this newscast, rain or shine, every weekday throughout the year. Joining us now are Paul and Aria to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio's Winter Membership Drive, and right now it's time to call us to support KBOO at 877-500-5266. I'm Aria, and I'm a volunteer here at KBOO, and I'm joined by Paul, another volunteer, and we're excited to be on the KBOO Evening News Show to share with you the importance of supporting a great programming like this. And I want to remind you, we at KBOO, we don't only have news, we also have music, like Bhangra from India, and we have Iranian news, which is spoken in Farsi. If you speak Farsi out there, you can also give your money, so you can hear your own language, and there's all types of music and news, and it's just community contributing to this radio station that no one else in Portland has.
And yeah, you know, we do. I'm Paul, and I know many of you have contributed already during our fall membership drive, and we do appreciate that. We really do appreciate that. It's how we keep going. But I also know that probably many more of you have actually never been a member of KBOO, or maybe have let your membership lapse, because most people who do listen to KBOO are not actually currently contributing members. And you know, we're not here to guilt trip you or anything, but just to note that, and note that nothing is for free, and this news broadcast does take money to put together, just the equipment itself. We've got a lot of new projects. We've got new production studios that we're in the process of making. We've got a bunch of new plans. Got a couple new co-station managers. We're very excited about that. KBOO, you know, is really on the upswing. I really feel it here. And if you want to be part of this, I know you value the station. I know you're listening to this, so you do appreciate the programming. Well, you can express that directly by giving us a call at 877-500-5266 and laying your money down on the line.
Yes, and if you don't want to call, you can go to our internet at kboo.fm.com.
Just .fm, actually.
Is it .fm? Okay. Yep. And, it is .fm. Sorry, my bad.
And before we go back to the news, I just want to remind you that there are a lot of ways to support KBOO, a lot of different, there's underwriting, there's various local businesses that we're in solidarity with or in solidarity with us, support us. We also have some restaurants. I'd like to thank Katie O'Brien's at 2809 Northeast Sandy Boulevard, Arroy Thai Cuisine at 506 Southwest 4th Avenue, and Corbett Fish House, which supplied tonight's dinner at 5901 Southwest Corbett Avenue. And let's go back to the news, but before that, call up at 877-500-5266. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On January 17th, fresh data was downloaded from two NASA satellites and distributed to a small group of researchers who track global water reserves. James Famiglietti, a hydrologist from University of California, Irvine, reviewed the satellite data with an increasing sense of doom. California, in the midst of an epic drought, is seeing its backup groundwater services running low. The losses can be picked up from satellites over 400 kilometers above the Earth's surface. 17 rural counties in California are in danger of running out of water within 60 days. There are many shocking moments ahead, and not just for California. Because of growing demands from agriculture and expanding population, energy production, and climate change, a billion people, or one in seven people on the planet, lack access to safe drinking water. A pattern seems to be developing. Countries at northern latitudes and in the tropics are getting wetter, while countries at mid-latitude are running increasingly low on water. The Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia are all areas protected to see water shortages due to overuse and poor management.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, February 10th, 2014. A Israeli soldiers invaded West Bank communities and kidnapped civilians. Meanwhile, settlers attack residents' cars. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli police demolished on Monday morning two Palestinian homes in Silwan and Jabal al-Mukabbar towns in occupied East Jerusalem. According to the homeowner in Silwan, Muhammad Sawahra, he built his home 18 years ago. Israel wanted to demolish the property, allegedly for not obtaining a permit, and Sawahra filed appeals that are still pending. Yet the army went ahead and demolished it, although Sawahra has been paying fines to the city council. In addition, soldiers invaded the home of Muhammad Ja'afra in Jabal al-Mukabbar and violently forced the family out. The soldiers then removed some of the furniture and destroyed the property without allowing the family to remove all of their belongings. Ja'afra said that the Jerusalem City Council imposed $12,000 fine on him and that he paid it all, yet the city council went ahead and demolished the home today. Staying in Jerusalem, a number of Israeli settlers invaded Wadi Yasul area in Silwan town, punctured tires of 30 Palestinian vehicles and sprayed racist graffiti. Residents told local media that the families found racist graffiti written in Hebrew on a number of walls and on a bus. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in occupied West Bank, violently broke into and searched dozens of homes and kidnapped several Palestinians. Invasions were reported in Nablus City, northern West Bank and nearby villages, in addition to Hebron and Bethlehem, southern West Bank. Also on Monday, dozens of soldiers invaded Na'lin town, west of the central West Bank city of Ramallah, and kidnapped two political leaders of the Hamas movement. Local sources said that the soldiers invaded the homes of the two leaders, violently searching them and causing property damage before kidnapping the two men. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 10, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
With a bill that would be devastating for women's rights about to hit the desk of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, more than a million people around the world have signed a petition urging him to veto the proposed law, which would protect perpetrators of domestic violence, child abuse, forced marriages, and marital rape. War took an increasing toll on Afghanistan's civilians in 2013 as fighting intensified between the government and insurgents, the United Nations said in a report on Saturday, with total casualties rising 14%. The gradual withdrawal of foreign troops has left Afghan government forces more vulnerable to attack by insurgents, and the resulting battles helped account for last year's rise in casualties, according to the report. The Afghan presidential campaign is underway, and on the surface, it looks like what you'd see in any other democracy. And underneath the decorations and sloganeering lies the shadowy practice of wooing tribal elders, warlords, and other influential Afghans who can deliver votes or, in some cases, prevent opponents' voters from making it to the polls.
You're listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalind Scott, Jenny Kangas, and Blake Fetterson. The producer is Joe Meyer. Special thanks to the reporters from Native News. You can find more national and international stories at their website. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yenka Soderberg. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on translator K282BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, we take your calls to discuss the top issues of the day. From 9 to 4 p.m., 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., it's KBOO's all-day special, The Day We Fight Back Against NSA Surveillance. KBOO will devote the full day on February 11th to a special day of programming on the People's Movement to Take Back the Internet. At 9, we speak with organizers of the Day of Action from thedaywefightback.org. At 9:30, we hear from Portland coder Thomas Schreiber about private social networking software and crypto parties. At 10, KBOO's Chris Andre speaks with Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation about encryption, cryptography, and how to keep your information safe in the age of mass surveillance. At 10:30, we hear a talk by internet activist Jacob Applebaum about the depth of NSA involvement in the government in the governance of the internet. At noon, we hear speakers from the memorial of the late internet activist Aaron Schwartz. Tune in all day to hear practical steps you can take to protect your online presence and ideas how to get involved in the fight to take back the internet. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Our membership drive is currently ongoing. Please help us by becoming a member or renewing. Call 877-500-5266. Volunteers are standing by, ready to take your call. Coming up next is Prison Pipeline, but first we go to Paul and Aria to talk about supporting people-powered community radio, the only 100% volunteer-hosted station in Oregon.
Yes, we are here. We ran over a little bit with the KBOO News, so we only have a short time here before Prison Pipeline, but we have enough time to remind you once again that we need your support to keep this great experiment in community building, community media, alternative information going for the foreseeable future. And the way to do that is by calling 877-500-5266. The phones have been kind of quiet, haven't they, Aria?
Yes, they have, and we need them ringing, actually. And we, if you don't want to call, you can go on the website and go to kboo.fm and contribute that way, and it's secure.
But we would like to hear those phones ringing, too. I mean, for us, we really we just get some satisfaction. We get kind of a thrill, you know, when we hear that phone ring. It means someone out there is taking to heart what we're saying, taking to heart this feeling of appreciation and mutual aid, mutual support for community media, for KBOO radio. So give us a call at 877-500-5266.
Remember, your money is tax deductible, actually.
That's true. So, you know, any amount that you give is going to come off your taxes at the end of the year. And you know, we know that tax day is coming up. Hate to remind you, folks, but it is coming up. It's inevitable in this day and age under the nation state, as it were. But we here try to, you know, provide a little bit of a buffer and try to let you know what's going on with the nation state. As you heard it with Democracy Now! With Jeremy Scahill. And
Glenn Greenwald.
Glenn Greenwald. How can I forget that name? These are great journalists, and we do, you know, support them by airing what they've got to say, like very few people will. So if you support that, if you support this kind of programming, the news that you just heard, this prison pipeline that's coming out right now, give us a call at 877-500-5266, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater Tuesday, February 11th, 2014 at 7 p.m. for our monthly KBOO movie night.
Manta! Manta!
To celebrate the 24th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison in South Africa, KBOO's Africa Oye will present the powerful documentary film A Mandala, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. Preceding the film will be a special short talk on the power of music in African society by Baba Wage Jakate, renowned artist and storyteller from Mali. That's Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m. Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:03, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is Prison Pipeline. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide can be found online at redirectguy.com.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are
good evening. This is Peter Pincel for Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. Welcome to another excellent edition. I'm here tonight with the entire collective. Myself, Karen James, Adam Carpinelli, Stephanie Guy, and Justin Chapin. We have a couple of new members this evening, and we're going to give them an opportunity to quickly introduce themselves right now. Justin, could you take it away and give us a couple seconds on yourself?
Yeah, my name is Justin Chapin, 26, went to school for economics. I just got here at the end of the summer, having a good time. I like Portland. I actually came from Portland, Maine. It's amazing how similar the two are. Tell that to everybody.
We know which one's better.
Well, don't tell me that.